Call this meeting to order of the Jobs and Economic Development Committee for February 1st. Groundhog's Day, is it? Okay. Welcome to our committee, Commissioner Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
Feels good, Mr. Chairman.
We would love to hear about the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation. What is it?
Yep, that's it. You got it right.
Board. Okay.
I hope not to make you bored by the end of this presentation.
I'm counting on that.
All righty. Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Tony Sertich. I'm the commissioner of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board and a former member of the House of Representatives and a former member of this committee. Good to be before you sitting at this table. I want to take an opportunity here to introduce many of you for the first time to an agency that you may not know quite what to call us or not quite sure what we do. But this is the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. I have a slideshow, which hopefully is in your packet of about 20-plus slides. Feel free to interrupt me at any time. I'm probably going to go first over an overview and then get into the numbers a little while later, but open to entertain any questions you have. Little history on the IRRB. It was started 70 years ago this year. It was actually started by Governor Harold Stassen at the time in the legislature back in 1941. This is a very unique state agency, and I would more classify it as a regional agency. And the reason why it's before this committee and before the legislature is for efficiency purposes. Back 70 years ago, Governor Stassen and the legislature saw that when they were mining these natural resources and the taconite out of the ground and the iron ore out of the ground, that they were mining a non-renewable resource. And they had the foresight to say that these natural resources were one day going to go away. They were going to mine as much as they could, and what was going to replace the economy in northeastern Minnesota after the taconite or the iron ore was mined. And so this agency was established at that time to look at diversifying the economy and looking at distressed regions with high unemployment from the boom and bust cycle of these natural resource economies. And so the IRRB was created at that time. The area of service in this unique agency is before you right there, and it's five counties. It's roughly three dozen cities and many townships and about 17 school districts encompass this region. And the reason for this service area is this is where mining has traditionally happened, everywhere from down in the Cuyuna Range of Aiken County through the Mesabi Range of the Hibbing, basically to Virginia Eveleth Gilbert area, to the Vermilion Range of Ely, and down on the shore, that's where the mines are. And so the reason this is a state agency is for efficiency purposes. Our agency is funded with zero general fund dollars. We don't impact the budget positively or negatively, as the case may be, in a deficit. But where we do impact the state's economy in our budget is we are an over $3 billion industry in the state of Minnesota. But this agency is funded because mines do not pay property taxes. They pay a production tax based on how many tonnage of iron ore pellets they take and ship out from northeastern Minnesota out east. And so the way that's collected is the Department of Revenue collects this production tax paid in lieu of property taxes at the state and then distributes it back to this area, which is called the Taconite Tax Relief Area. And when they established this area, it was thought of because there are six mines up there and there were a few more back then. And for example, I live in Chisholm. The largest employer in the city of Chisholm is not located in Chisholm. It's Hibbing Taconite, the mine that's located just 6 miles down the road. And there are many other small towns like that where most of the employees work at a mine which may be in a town next door. So they collected this production tax regionally, and then there's a formula within the tax committee that distributes it. Now most of the funding goes to cities and school districts, counties and townships, and then whatever is left over then goes to the IRRB, the state agency which is tasked with doing economic diversification. And so that's the history of the service area that that this unique agency represents. We can only spend within this area, and that's where the tax is collected. Our agency has three main focuses. It's right there in our state statutes. The first one is business development, the second is community development, and the third is workforce development. We work with area businesses to help them We work with our communities primarily in infrastructure ways, and we work on workforce development issues both within our school districts, but then working with workforce development to meet the needs of our local businesses. First area is business development. I can sit here and tell you about many of the success stories that have happened primarily in the manufacturing and service areas, but what we look at is when we're looking to diversify our economy, and that is something that we'll never be done with because you continually have to diversify to be competitive. We look to replace mining jobs when they go away with other good-paying jobs. And here's one example. This is a small business, Minnesota Twist Drill, and it's a great success story. This business has actually been around since the 1940s and was locally owned and operated, but then at a time was sold to some outside investors. Local investors bought it back again and just had a unique opportunity in the last year to buy a company down in Illinois and insource jobs to Minnesota. They make drill bits, and in the past they made everything from the drill bits you could buy at Lowe's or Home Depot or your local hardware store, but they do more high-end drill bits right now. And a great little manufacturing company, we were able to help them.
And this is Sturdish, wasn't that one that was built with the help with the job zone?
Mr. Chair, we tried to do it with a job zone, but we could not at the time because they were creating within their existing plant area. They were not expanding their business to other property. So it was one we looked at one point, though.
I think Jackson did that. So yep. Need some help, call me.
Okay, sounds good. Well, Mr. Chair and members, they had the opportunity to buy an existing other business and insource those jobs to Minnesota and to northeastern Minnesota. And what is great about how we help some small businesses, we really look at those businesses that are existing within our communities, and that's going to be a major focus of the Dayton administration and my work at the IRRRB. Is we don't have to convince the local CEOs and business leaders of Minnesota Twist Roll to invest in northeastern Minnesota. They already live there. They like to hunt and fish and snowmobile. Their kids go to the schools already. So it's not a sell of trying to find somebody from Alabama and throwing a ton of money at them to come to northeastern Minnesota. They're already there. And so it's what can we do to help them? And what we did is we provided them some gap financing, actually helped the city of Chisholm with some infrastructure funding to make sure that they could expand their business in northern Minnesota. So they worked with their existing capital. They went to a bank for a loan, and we were the gap financing to make sure they could bring these jobs. And now they have over 111 employees at good wages. And actually, last year in a downturn in economy, had profit sharing for their employees. And like I said, brought jobs from Illinois, which could have been outsourced to India or China or anywhere else in the world, came to Minnesota. And so we work with small manufacturers, large manufacturers, service areas, fabrication, businesses all over the region. And primarily, when they work with a bank, we try to help gap finance and either work with the local community on infrastructure needs or directly help these businesses create jobs. The second piece we work on is community development. Because this tax is collected regionally, and I was talking to some folks before, because the ground literally shakes when these mines blast, infrastructure is an issue in many of our small communities in northeastern Minnesota. And so we help everything from, this is Mountain Iron, where we helped with some infrastructure of $550,000 for a business park, which has now a new $9 million Holiday Inn Express and is going to expand with potentially $2 million more of a conference center. Lake Country Power has a building and employees there, and there was a new Perkins on that lot. We help in Hibbing. This is the Fairview Hospital in Hibbing. Our small $750,000 infrastructure grant to the city of Hibbing leveraged over $9 million of construction to make the Fairview Hospital in Hibbing the only level 3 trauma center north of Duluth. Created 7 to 10 new jobs and were, of course, construction jobs as well. This is the closest hospital to Esser Steel, which I'll be talking about later. But it's interesting, when Esser Steel, which is a new mining venture in northeastern Minnesota, which is going to go from not just pellet production to actually steel and the value add of doing steel in Minnesota instead of sending our product out east to get the value add. When they were looking to locate in northeastern Minnesota, they looked for four important things. They first looked to our schools to see how our school system were, where their employees were going to come from and where their kids were going to go to school. The second thing they looked for was how our healthcare system was in northeastern Minnesota and having this level 3 trauma center. Making sure that for workplace safety that they had a facility to take their employees, God forbid if something happened at their site, this was something that was important to them. The third thing they looked for was our infrastructure and our transportation system and the like, and the fourth thing was quality of life. What can I do after 5 o'clock or 7 o'clock or on weekends when you're done with work? And we've got a lot to offer when it comes to quality of life as well. We have worked in, for example, the city of Mountain Iron on housing development. This is a unity addition to the city of Mountain Iron. Our housing stock is very old up there right now, and this was our ability, two grants totaling $500,000 to the city of Mountain Iron for water, sewer, and road. They are going to, are currently in construction of 27 new single-family homes with a $6.7 million value to their community. Good tax base, new homeowners, new home construction for a new generation of workers and entrepreneurs in northern Minnesota. And then one, and I wish Representative David Dill was here because I put this in here specifically for him. This is up in his communities he represents, Silver Bay, an assisted living center. We worked with water and sewer and site preparation of $350,000, which leveraged $2.7 million of this 34-bed assisted living facility, including memory units. For the city of Silver Bay and the surrounding area, most of the folks who lived in this assisted living, they didn't have the capacity there, so they had to drive to Duluth or even further to visit their family. This brought those people back to our communities, and most importantly, 25 new jobs for the small city of Silver Bay. The third area we focus on is workforce development. And if you look on this slide, we've been doing some innovative work over the past few years. We have what is called the Applied Learning Initiative, and this is where we've invested working with our local high schools, the 17 or so high schools, partnering with our community and technical colleges in applied learning, which is the technical and vocational skills. We have over 1,500 students now that are working with our local businesses, with our community and technical colleges, high school students, getting the skills they need to be successful in a new economy in the areas of technical and workforce education. We have a four-year engineering program. We're partnering with Mankato State University. Right now in northeastern Minnesota, north of Duluth, we don't have any four-year universities or institutions. We all have all two-year institutions. So now we've developed, in partnership with Mankato State, an engineering program, which is very important to our timber producers, our mining producers, is having these engineers for these large-scale facilities. And they can get their four-year engineering degree right now on the Iron Range with these partnerships. We've also partnered with UMD for a master's in engineering program as well that they can get right on the Iron Range. And we've done renewable and power generation at Itasca Community College, wind and millwright programs at Mesabi Community College, and we've started a solar program at the Hibbing Community College. This is the business communities partnering with higher education institutions, partnering with the IRRRB to look at these new job opportunities in northern Minnesota. And then this slide's hard to read, and I don't expect you to read it, but I just want you to show the large-scale projects that are happening or potentially could happen all over northeastern Minnesota. And if you basically look at this, and you can't read the details, but every box on there is a large potential development, whether it be an expansion at Keewatin Taconite, an existing taconite plant, to Esser Steel, to the new copper-nickel ventures. If you look to the far right of the map, those are all major large-scale developments that we play a role in, but not as large a role as our friends in the PCA and the DNR when it comes to permitting. But we definitely play a role in fostering these large development projects in our natural resource economy. I just want to take a look at a few of these larger developments that you may have heard about or will be hearing about shortly. My first day on the job as a state legislator was back in 2001. I think it was approximately January 3rd or 4th. It was the very same day that LTV Steel announced they were shutting down. This was an existing mine in the Aurora Hoyt Lakes area, and we lost 1,400 jobs on that one day in 2001. And we've been looking to replace them. And one of the ways we did that was we made some investments both at the IRRRB and at DEED to make sure that we got this new generation of mining in northeastern Minnesota. We've went from pellet production to this nugget, which actually is a value add and is more efficient use for the blast furnaces out east in making steel. This is a $300 million investment where the state played a role with $42.5 million. There were 100 construction jobs and 500 construction jobs, 100 permanent jobs, and they just started producing their first nuggets 1 year ago last year. And it's the new way of mining taconite, and I'm hopeful that if they're successful, some of the existing plants can use this technology or similar technology to add value to their product. Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, what percentage of iron is in these nuggets?
It's a much higher percentage because of the silica and the oxygen is less when you make a nugget instead of a pellet, so that's where the value is added, and the iron content is much higher in these pellets.
It's like the old iron ore.
It's when red ore went to taconite, this is the next step from taconite to nuggets. Yeah. Another great project is magnetation. This is a local entrepreneur who found a way back when they mined the red ore and they had tailings basins. They left a lot of the product behind, and we're able to reclaim that, or magnetation is able to reclaim that. And you see that dome that's over a tailings basin, and they're able, through new processes, to reclaim some of the value out of the tailings basins and the old overburden. And so this company was started, a $5.5 million investment company, 56 permanent jobs, 15 construction jobs, and actually they're now partnering with Cargill and just started a partnership where they're going to bring this all over the world to different countries that have that they can still find value out of old tailings basins and old overburden. And so it's an exciting venture with, like I said, a local entrepreneur from Palo, Minnesota, who's been in the mining industry his entire life. They're starting here. They're going to Mexico. They're going all over the world with this product. And these jobs started in northeastern Minnesota.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Sertich, regarding this magnetation group, I'm just kind of curious. In the early days, a lot of those taconite tailings were dumped right into Lake Superior until the state changed that, and then they started to dump them on land. How long will the source of those tailings last, in your estimation, to make this work? Because it is using a previous dumping product, and now we're using it for good. So I'm just kind of curious how long you think that will last, based upon how many tailings we've got stored.
Commissioner Sertich.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scalzi, it depends on the tailings basins. They're literally going to be hopscotching across the Iron Range, and then they can go all over the world. And I don't know what the products all over the world are, but I know we will have the home base here in Minnesota. They're in the process of doing their first tailings basin and starting on their second one already. So this could be decades they could be doing this if they can find an efficient way, an economic way of getting this product out of the tailings basins. But it could be decades. Mr. Chair and members, the last major project I want to touch on before I get into the meat of this agency and the numbers is Esser Steel. As I said earlier, this is something that Minnesotans had wanted to do ever since we found iron ore and taconite in northeastern Minnesota. It's actually doing the value add, making the steel in Minnesota. For generations, we have shipped the product out east to Pittsburgh and Cleveland and others, and that's where the value added happened. And when they made the steel out there, that's when they made the cars and the refrigerators and everything else. And if we always thought if we could get the steel production here, the manufacturing jobs could come as well. And so finally, Esser Steel, which is an Indian company, stepped forward and is in the process of a $1.65 billion investment in northeastern Minnesota and Representative Anzell's district. The state of Minnesota stepped up with $71.9 million between DEED and the IRRRB. This will be 500 permanent jobs and over 2,000 construction jobs. They started pouring the footings last fall, and hopefully they'll be progressing on from there. The IRRRB put in $6 million of it, and $65.9 came from DEED through the 21st Century Minerals Fund that the chair and I know a great deal a bit about.
I still have some bruises.
All right. So this agency, as I said before, zero state dollars come to this agency. It's all based on the production tax. And it's paid by a three-year average. Because of the boom and bust of mining, it was thought of a long time ago by people smarter than I that we should average out how we pay this out. And so you see right here the production of tons of iron ore over the course of the past few years. And you see on the furthest side of the graph, we had a very bad year back in 2009 where the production went from almost 40 million tons down to 17 million tons. And so this is going to significantly impact our agency's budget. But it won't be all in one year, as you see, because of the three-year averaging, we have a more stable funding for the agency. And then it's very clear within the state statutes how we're to spend these funds and where they go. As I said before, the production tax first gets sent and invested to in cities and townships and counties and school districts, and we get the smallest and last piece of the pie, which is in fiscal year 11, $27 million. And then part of it goes to operations and can be funded for board projects. The other part is designated into a few different funds. The first one is the DJJ, the Douglas J. Johnson Fund, which is a trust that was established. We live off the interest of that, funds the agency, and it's really our seed money, our investment into the future. The other piece goes to paying off some revenue bonds for our school districts, the higher education account, which helped develop those projects that you saw earlier, and the TEDF, the Taconite Economic Development Fund, which is a rebate fund to mines within state statute. You guys are all looking behind me. Are there a bunch of Rangers in the room now? I thought so. Just Rick Avina. All right.
But they've all stopped in.
There they all are. Great. All right. The TEDF is a rebate program that's given to back to mining companies to make sure they keep up with their workforce development and also environmental concerns on the existing mines. So you saw this is where the revenue comes in. The production tax is the primary funder of the agency. We try to keep a very healthy carry forward because of the boom and bust. We want to make sure we have the resources that we can invest both into our operations, our ongoing expenses, and then our programs and projects. We get a little bit from investment earnings. That number has obviously been higher in the past of the DJJ fund. We work with the Minnesota Board of Investments, has our DJJ fund, and we work with them closely on what of our investment earnings are. We have our loan revenue back from the business deals we do. The loans to businesses are paid back. Facility revenues are primarily at Giants Ridge, and we'll get more into the details of that later. And we deal with an occupation tax for an outlying region that used to be in the TTRA, the Taconite Relief Area, that still passes through the agency. Our expenses are as follows: operations, programs, and projects. Operations look high, and I'll give you the reason why here in a minute. Northeastern Minnesota was founded on the three T's, taconite, timber, and tourism, and those are still three key pieces of the stool of our economy. And if we look deeper into the operations, the Eveleth office is where I'm located. I'm the only commissioner that is located in rural Minnesota. So if you need me down at this committee or if you have any questions where you need me in person, just please give me a three-hour heads up. The rest of the commissioners are across the street or down the hall, but I'm 3 hours away. So the Eveleth office is that $6 million of operations. The Minnesota Discovery Center, formerly Iron World, is our museum. And basically, it does what the Minnesota Historical Society does throughout the state. We keep all of the documents that are both public documents, city documents, county documents. We have immigration records. If any of your ancestors immigrated over, we can find those documents in northeastern Minnesota, the ship records, and you name it. And then we also run Giants Ridge Golf and Ski Resort, which I can discuss at great length. And if there are any questions at that, that's a significant portion of our operations, but it's actually going to be shrinking because the Giants Ridge Golf and Ski Resort, the ski part of it started in the 1980s. The golf came in the 90s before I got there. But what we did was establish the ski hill and then two golf courses. And this operations number is going to be shrinking because we just paid off the bonds for the second golf course recently. And these are the agency facilities. We have a facility over in Chisholm, which is mineland reclamation. One of the key pieces, the rehabilitation piece that we do, is when the mines dig a hole, what they leave is a big hole that fills up with water with a bunch of red ore dirt around it. Right here, we do some growth of some trees, and we're able to plant those trees back up and rehabilitate the grounds that were mined in the past. As I said before, Iron World, the Minnesota Discovery Center, our museum located in Chisholm, that does both the museum aspect but then holds the artifacts and the collections of different state departments, county departments, and city hall minutes and the like, and you name it, is right at this facility. It is now managed by a nonprofit. We contract. We own all of the Minnesota artifacts and history, but we have a nonprofit that manages it, local people. And I think that's a better way to go because generally what happens, and I'm the newest one, a new commissioner comes in with a new idea, new thoughts, and a new direction for this agency, and we thought that it'd be better to have local people manage this in a nonprofit way to give it some more stability so it wasn't, you know, a museum 1 year and a water park the next year and God knows what the year after that. And so it has a little more stability managed by a local nonprofit. And they also have the ability to go for outside grants and to up the revenue so that our resources aren't just paying for it. They can work with the Smithsonian and other national and international organizations to get different revenue into that facility. The third piece is Giants Ridge. Most of the cross-country ski trails in northeastern Minnesota, some downhill skiing and sledding and now tubing, and also golf. And tourism is a large factor for northeastern Minnesota, and now this is a four-season tourist destination. The Giants Ridge Recreation Area actually is 10,000 acres, and we, as the IRRRB, own 1,850 of those acres, so about a tenth of those acres, and we're developing it with private investment as well. And just in the course of the past decade or so, there's been $65 million of private investment in this area as well, and we're looking to develop further both private commercial and residential developments at this area. So don't just think of it as the ski hill and the golf courses, and I encourage you all to come up there and do both, but to see the private investment that's happening there as well.
Representative Paymore.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. I always thought, maybe I was wrong, because I lived in northern Minnesota when Giants Ridge was created, and I always was under the impression that there was supposed to be an initial public investment into this facility, and it was supposed to spin off as a private entity. And here, 30 years later, it still seems like it's a public entity funded by the IRRRB. Mm-hmm. Am I wrong on my historical recollection of that?
Mr.
Chair and Representative Paymar, it actually started as a private entity before the 1980s
failed,
and failed.
Yes.
And it was reconstituted, and it may have been thought at one time to do it, but much as, and you're familiar with the city of Duluth, they have a public ski hill there, and many of the communities all across the state of Minnesota have public golf courses and other amenities. It's been the mission of the agency to maintain it as a public facility.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Surridge, just to follow up on that question, is there a financial report on that? Like, how much money is that resort golfing complex? I mean, it's obviously losing money. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem like a great business to be in. I'm just curious, what are the financials on that?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative, it's about a... per year, we invest about $8 million into it. Its revenue back recently has been around $4 million. Clearly, with the way the economy has been going recently, you know, the tourism sector is hit hard, not just for us, but all over both public and private amenities. And so, but actually about $1 million of that is going to come off the books because of we paid off the bonds for the second golf course. And so it is subsidized, much like many other amenities are, especially in the areas of tourism. There's a subsidy there. But it brings in about 130,000 visitors a year, and it helps our local economy by attracting people in all four seasons to northeastern Minnesota, and kind of is our marquee tourism of the three T's.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, if it failed in like 30 years ago when it first started, and it's failed recently, has it ever been a success in any of those years?
Commissioner.
Financially.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would not call it a failure, actually. If you look at it being ranked as two of the best golf courses in the United States, is it subsidized? Yes. Is it a failure? No. When you get 130,000 bodies coming to northeastern Minnesota, I see that as a success. It's an investment we've made. It's a subsidy or an investment, whatever you want to call it. But it's certainly attracted issues of quality of life. And I don't think private businesses, private developers would be investing the $60-plus million in this overall recreational area that we do not own that are adjacent to it if it was a failure.
Representative Stensrud.
Perhaps I should rephrase my question. Has it ever made money without millions of dollars going in each year? I guess that's my question.
Sure.
I mean, how you gauge it a success. Let's just talk bottom line. Has it ever made more money than was put into it?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, my figures right here only go back a few years, and no, it has not.
Is there a long-term plan? It seems like a losing proposition. I mean, there's a lot of big picture things about tourism, but to lose money every year, it'd be nice to spin that off to private industry and let them take a shot at it, because somebody's left holding the bag, and it's kind of the taxpayers or the tax funds that are coming through.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that's a good question. I think if private business were to be successful there, they would have come to us already. We've we've always been open to finding new and different ways to fund that, but I would kind of throw this back in a few different ways. I don't see this as necessarily needing to be a money-making venture, just as our state parks. You could call that a financial loss because we subsidize our state parks and other tourist and public amenities that are here for the quality of life, where we spend more money than we get. And I see this as a similar example of a facility. And if you ask many communities across Minnesota that has that have golf courses or swimming pools or other ski hills in different parts of the state, they all are subsidized to a certain extent. But we certainly don't call our state park system a losing venture because there's subsidy there. And I see this in a similar vein, that it attracts people to northeastern Minnesota. It helps our tourism economy. And those 130,000 people that come visit Giants Ridge then spend money in the communities, and they stay in the hotels. And it's also a way that we attract businesses to northeast Minnesota with the skiing, with the golfing, and the like.
Mr. Leidiger.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just want to follow up on that. Are there, I don't know the area that well in terms of the recreation that's up there. How many other ski resorts are up there that the state-owned entity has to compete with?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a good question. That's the reason that this started. There are none in a 50-plus mile radius from this. You have to go way up the shore to Lutzen or down to Duluth to get to a ski hill, and those are hours away. That would be like saying that a business in downtown Minneapolis would be competing with a business in St. Cloud or Rochester. It's about the same distance, to put in perspective to folks down here.
Well, may I follow up? Have there ever been any other ski resorts that are up there that were operating in competition with this organization?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, there is not. This is the biggest hill we got up there. The rest of them are pretty small. It'd be a pretty short trip down the hill, so this is it.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And to my colleagues at the table, I have a couple of friends that actually have timeshares up there. They actually, apparently, they're, when you do the timeshare, you do actually pay a bit of a property tax. And between the friends and family that go up there, they're spending approximately 6 weeks up there, whether it's in winter or in the summer. And I should be a little crabby because they're probably taking money out of the metro area and spending it up north. But the other part to that is the restaurants. Having been there myself and played on that golf course, by the way, could you get an easier golf course? the amount of money spent by urban people up there does create the jobs, and it is part of how economic development works. We just sometimes you have to subsidize the main attraction to get the restaurants, the hotels, and the museums being used by other people, which creates another tax base for us.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm almost done with my presentation, and we'll still be open to answering questions. We can look at the employee complement at the agency. We were up over 80 employees earlier last decade, and we're now down to about 56 full-time employees at the agency, and they're split between Giants Ridge facility, the Mineland Reclamation, and then our main office in Eveleth. We talked about operations now, and I'm going to move to projects. This past year, we had budgeted $15 million for projects. $9.5 million is for business development. That's working with individual businesses to create jobs. $4 million of that is public works, funding to communities for sewer and wastewater and the like. And then $1.5 million in a wage subsidy program that was actually spearheaded by Representative Rukavina and was modeled after a MEAD program that the former Economic Development Agency had during the Perpich administration of the 80s. This actually helped many of our small businesses in a rough economy hire employees, and they had hit a certain wage threshold to qualify, but they were able to hire employees even during a tough economy. 124 small businesses on the range took advantage of this, and the average hourly wage was $11 an hour, and there were 337 small business hires just with this program. Very successful. I've been to Chamber of Commerce events just in the past few weekends where small Main Street business owners came up to me and said, thank you, we were able to hire another truck driver, we were able to hire somebody else in the back because of this program, and we still have them kept on well after the wage subsidy went away. But when you look at the project,
Representative Rokovina was a golf pro there at one time?
At Giants Ridge?
Yeah.
Was not a golf pro. He usually only carries around one club.
I just heard a rumor.
When you're talking about the leverage, though, when you look at that investment, I had our staff look back over the past 2.5 years. We in the area of projects, we have invested $47 million. The return on investment of outside our agency resources was $250 million of private and other public resources outside of our agency. So a 5-to-1 leverage return on investment in the businesses and the public works infrastructure that we've done. And so I think that's a pretty good return on investment, even in the past 2.5 years, is 5-to-1 private to our investment at the agency, and will have created almost 3,000 jobs just in the business deals over the past 2.5 years. An area that we've gotten into is renewable energy recently, because one of those other T's I talked about, timber, is a major natural resource and part of our economy. We have worked with two of our public utilities, both in Virginia and Hibbing, which used to burn coal, and we've helped invest to make sure they can do biomass, and started the Laurentian Energy Authority. These are two communities that dislike each other when it comes to basketball or hockey, but are working well together for biomass, and we're able to use our wood products. After they go out into the forest and cut down trees, they take the tops and the limbs, and they bring them back, and they're able to use them as a clean, renewable energy at both the Hibbing and Virginia PUCs. Good for the environment, good for our local loggers, and has helped retain 70 positions, 350 construction jobs to convert these two public utilities, and has helped with 65 to 100 jobs in the wood harvesting and handling industry. We've also looked into solar technology. There's a plant being built in Mountain Iron right now to build solar panels, and actually the solar panels are going to be used in the XL service area. When you do solar, it's really all about the return on investment. How long is it going to take you to recognize the savings or to pay back your investment in solar technology, whether it be at your business or at your home? They have some great solar panels that are damn near indestructible. I've seen very heavy people jump on them, and they can't break them. So they're the highest of quality. And between an investment return through Xcel and through the state of Minnesota, we've gotten the return on investment down under 10 years, which is going to make good sense for homeowners in the Xcel service area and businesses to start investing in the solar technology, where they can actually have their meter spin backwards and send energy back into the grid, which is going to be good for our environment, but also good for these small businesses and these local homeowners. And we've also, of course, invested in wind technology on Taconite Ridge and in other areas. And what we'd love to do is actually build the turbines and the blades more in Minnesota. I know in southern Minnesota they have a few of these, but we think we have a good place for actually manufacturing the turbines and the blades in northeastern Minnesota. We're centrally located in the United States. We're right by a port. We have good rail. We have good roads. And we're always looking for new opportunities in wind development, not just with the wind regime up there and doing the windmills, and this is a picture of a windmill in northeastern Minnesota, but also manufacturing it as well. So this agency is all about jobs, jobs, and jobs, and that is very good because the Dayton administration is always about getting Minnesotans back to work, whether it be at Delta Airlines, or whether it be at Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Ryan's Rustic Rails, a small manufacturer of rails and other wood products, or Delta Dental in Representative Brookavina's district. We have a quality workforce that we can sell all over the nation and all over the world. And we do have an interesting, and as I said, it's a unique agency. I don't think you'll find another one that comes before this committee or any other committee that has this sort of mission, but also is just this specific to this area of the state. I should tell you a bit about, just for an example, and this is how a project happens. We get a lead at the agency. Say a community comes to us and says, a business X wants to expand, but we need some help with wastewater infrastructure. So they come to our agency, and we work with them and maybe a bank or others to develop some funding for them. As commissioner, I present this to a board of 13 people. And those are the folks that actually decide how the money is spent at the IRRRB. And this board is appointed, 5 members of the House appointed by Speaker Zellers, 5 senators appointed by Majority Leader Koch, and 3 citizen members, one each appointed by those two leaders and one appointed by the governor. And that 13-member board then votes on our budget, but then also votes on individual projects. I then have to sign off on the project as commissioner, and then the governor signs off. So it's very unique. And you are going to be getting the governor's budget book shortly. and you will have a piece of the budget book will say IRRRB, and there will be a budget in there, but that is only our best guesstimate because we do not have the final production tax numbers from the mining companies and the Department of Revenue yet. We should be getting those numbers in the next week or so. And so that's when we start developing our budget, and our budget has to be approved by that board. It's not necessarily approved by this committee or the legislature. It's approved by that 13-member board, and we will be doing that in June. And so we run an annual budget. So as I said, we're unique in many sorts of ways, and I just appreciate the opportunity to be before this committee to explain a little bit of our uniqueness and how we operate.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Sertich, I've got a couple of questions on a spreadsheet. And I would assume you'll have the answers right away. But like the Attorney General, you've got two columns in here where you're giving him money out of different funds, one out of the Doug Johnson Fund and the other from the board. Why do we do that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Howes, just like every other agency, we contract with the Attorney General's office, and it has to be taken out of two different accounts because the Attorney General deals with helping write our contracts that we do with businesses and communities, but the Attorney General's office also gives us opinions and helps us with our expenditures out of the Doug Johnson Fund, whether it be the investments or actually spending money out of the Doug Johnson Fund. So because of how the statutes are lined up, we have to pay for them out of both funding areas.
Okay, two more questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative House.
Mr. Sertich, also under the Environmental Protection Fund, when you read it, you think that's money you're saving to put black dirt and grass over the Thacamet tailings when you're all done, but I see a lot of money comes out of that, so is that for other things than just protecting the environment, obviously?
Mr. Chair and Representative House, yes, it is. It has to do with reclamation and others as well. Under the statute, it was named the Environmental Protection Fund, but the statutes have since been updated since the 1940s, and so there are other reasons for expending that money. But we stick right to what the statutes say.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one more. You know, it's always been a myth down here. Mm-hmm. I've used that term loosely, that the Rangers, Democrats from the Iron Range, run the IRRRB, and they run it into the ground, or they run it as close as they can and as long as they can fund their projects that they can't get through the bonding bill. And I know it looked pretty hopeless for the Rangers to get anything out of the bonding bill this year. I was wondering if they were going to continue that myth, but I've heard a rumor that there are going to be six Republicans appointed to the IRRRB. Do you see a problem with that?
Mr. Chair and Board Member House, actually, there are a lot of myths about the IRRRB, and one is that it's just run by Democrats. Well, the commissioner of this agency has been a Republican for the better part of the past two decades, and governors have to sign off on every project that moves forward. So Governor Plenty has actually signed off on all expenditures at this agency for the past 8 years, and Governor Ventura and Carlson before him, before you even get to Governor Perpich. We've always had Republicans that have sat on the board. Always, and we look forward to more of you sitting on the board so you can understand the uniqueness of this agency. And since I have the mic for one extra second, the other myth is, and this is only the third time I've said it, but it is so misunderstood by the public, we do not have any state tax dollars in this agency, and that's always a frustration of mine is elected officials don't understand that, but almost more importantly, the press always picks up that, you know, the Rangers are spending your tax, I saw this on a local TV station down here, they're spending your tax dollars on whatever business up in northern Minnesota, and we get different TV channels down there, so we're not spending, I'm looking across this room now, we're not spending any of your tax dollars at the IRRRB, because Representative Dill's not here, I can say that. It's all local tax dollars from northern Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Paymar.
Commissioners, I missed this when I came in a few minutes late. Did you talk at all about PolyMet? And I just was...
I did not know.
Okay. Has the IRRRB made any contributions via grants, loans, to PolyMet as of this date? And does the IRRRB intend to in the future? Or is that not decided yet?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, I think that's a very good question. We have always played a role in major, large economic development, natural resource projects in northeastern Minnesota. At a December board meeting, the board voted to give a $4 million loan to PolyMet to help with a land swap issue they were having with the U.S. Forest Service. They have to do some wetland exchanges as a part of their project, and we were going to loan them money. They were going to pay it back, and actually we had a great deal put in place where we got some warrants for stock options, and then if the deal fell all apart, if PolyMet were to not move forward, this agency would actually then take over that land, which would have been great for us because one parcel of that land or a major portion of that land was right near Giants Ridge, where our major development is and other private development. But we could have used that in the future for future economic development projects that had to do this wetland mitigation. There has since been a lawsuit that is put in place, and I believe the lawsuit is premature because the money was never awarded. So there has not been a final decision on that money. A lawsuit has been filed with the understanding that their reading of some of a rule and also some state laws that we cannot participate while PolyMet is in a EIS process, which they've been in for the past 5 and almost 6 years. And so we have not given any money to PolyMet at this time.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Leidiger.
Sir. Mr. Chairman, wanted to ask a question about the Esser Steel. When is that plant supposed to come online, and do you know how they're going to ship the finished product?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, Esser Steel, as I said, poured footings this last year. They're hoping to be online by 2012 or 2013 with just taconite, and they're going to ship their taconite. They own a facility up in Canada as well until they can then construct their steel mill. They're doing it hopefully at the same time where they're starting with their taconite plant. They're going to start producing taconite as they're finishing building the actual steel mill itself. And so that is a few more years down the road towards the end of this decade. But, you know, when you're building a $1.65 billion investment, it's going to take a little while to do that. And the way they'll ship is by rail and then to the water, to Lake Superior. And then if they're actually doing the steel and then doing the production, the manufacturing jobs, they have rail opportunities, trucking opportunities, and the like after that. But it would take a little while when they go through their phases. The first phase is the taconite plant, and then the second phase is actually doing the steel mill.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize, Commissioner Sertich. I'm really sorry I wasn't here for most of your presentation, but so if this question's already been asked, then you can just tell me. But what was the name of the movie again that you were in that dealt with the Iron Range story up there?
Yeah, the movie was North Country. It was filmed a few years ago. We actually made a small investment in that as well. We did a rebate program that if they filmed in northeastern Minnesota and they collected their receipts, we gave them a bit of a rebate. They did over $3 million of local business, our local construction and food and beverage, and they stayed actually up at Giants Ridge at the private hotel and some other areas. And so it was an over $3 million economic impact to the state of Minnesota. Part of my background before I was a legislator and before I was, when I was in college, I was a theater major, and so I was an extra in the movie, and I like to refer to myself as leering steelworker number two. If you blink, you'd miss me. I was on screen, I think, at the 19-minute, 21-second mark of the movie, and if you ever, I'll show you on my iPad sometimes, I can show you that little blur across the screen. They wrote out, Representative Rukavina was supposed to have a very intimate scene with Charlize Theron, but I think that landed... that was left on the cutting room floor, unfortunately, for Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Thank you for that history, and I think it was really a great movie.
Wonderful, yeah.
One of the things about that movie was talking about the role of women in the whole struggle in the Iron Range, and I'm just wondering if you could review for us a little bit where that's at in terms of wages now and opportunities for women and the IRRB's work on that.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, it is very important to get to a place of equity, and of course that movie dealt with the struggle of the introduction, really, of women in the workforce and in the workforce of our mines, and it was a very rocky time. I'm proud to tell you right now that there are so many more women working in the mines and in much better conditions and in key positions in our labor unions and at actually some of the mines. When you look at PolyMet, one of the key players of PolyMet is a young woman who was raised on the Iron Range, and she's playing a key role in helping move that project forward in the environmental area. And so you see that across the range. But we have a great story that there's definitely a black eye there in the history of mining. But I just think back to my little town of Chisholm. And the publisher of our newspaper up there was the first female news publisher in the nation, Vita Punikvar, who's still alive, living up there, and very active in our communities. Many of our local mayors and city council members, long before I was around, were women. And so they've played key roles in the past. Certainly there was a difficult time, as I said, in the past in some of the more natural resource-based economies, but we're moving in the right direction there. And, of course, at the mines, they do the same jobs. They get paid the same wages, and we're getting equity there. And I'm hopeful. We haven't seen as many entrepreneurs come forward in small businesses, but I'm hopeful that we see that more and more as the years go on at the agency, and we'll certainly stand to invest in any with any entrepreneurs moving forward in our economy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Representative Stenzer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. You know, thank you, Chairman. On the Mesabi Nugget, are there any other, I mean, this one gets me excited when I look at, I mean, these are real jobs, and I mean, there's some real opportunity with that. Are there any, I was just talking with a manufacturing kind of guru just the other day, and he was talking about, you know, this iron nugget, you know, mm-hmm. the new technology. When will you be, they're going to only do taconite now, and when, what point will it be this new nugget, or is it?
Mr. Chair and Representative, they started last January making the nugget and okay. using this new technology. And we have the NRRI, Natural Resource Research Institute, that's funded somewhat through mining royalties and in other ways, and they're always looking to develop new technologies moving forward. This was a private technology that we invested a bit in, and we're hopeful that other companies will invest in new technologies like this. We're always looking for that next value add that we can do, much like when it went from Redar to Taconite, now Taconite to Nuggets. We're hopeful, and we will continue to invest and make sure companies are looking for new and better processes to make this. But we're also going to take a major focus because I believe strongly in our local small businesses, and when you talk to the folks on Main Street, they're the ones that, you know, we can throw a ton of dough at a company in Alabama to try to relocate them to northeastern Minnesota, or we can create jobs 5 or 10 at a time at 50 or 100 small businesses on the range where they already have existing roots. And so we're going to look beyond those natural resources, maybe to some of the vendors. And so many of our small business success stories were in our vendors to our mines, but then they've opened up to new markets and new products and are able to then work in this international economy. And so we're going to really look inward as well and see. And really, my major question I'll be asking all the small businesses, not just in northeastern Minnesota, but all over, is what can we do to help you? How can we help your business grow? And if that means a small amount of capital, or if we have to partner with a bank, or if we can help open some doors, and Governor Dayton is committed, as you all know and have heard, that he will go anywhere in the state, nation, or world to help create jobs for all of Minnesota. We have a good partner in the governor's office, and you'll be hearing from the new deed commissioner soon, and we're going to really be a team. And really, what happens in northeastern Minnesota, you know, will affect everybody around this table, because if I look into the zip codes of all the vendors of our mines or our timber industry, I can look at almost every one of your districts and find an engineering firm or a manufacturer or a vendor who does business with these folks. My favorite one is in Rosemount, and that's where the dynamite, that's where they buy the dynamite to actually blow up the rock. And so we even get that from another part of the state. As I said before, a $3-plus billion industry for Minnesota. And, you know, when northeastern Minnesota is humming along and our economy's going well, our state's going well, and with a $6 billion deficit, what we can do to grow jobs and to grow the tax base and to make sure that we got the monies in the coffers and the businesses are going the right direction, we're going to do all we can in northern Minnesota to help the entire state.
Not seeing any more questions, thank you very much for a great presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to Deed for the use of their computer. We're already working together.
Yeah, members, well, we got a minute here where they're setting up. Mr. Light, Representative Leidiger approved the minutes of January 27th. He said he read them thoroughly, and he thinks they're great minutes. And we now, everyone approves the minutes. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
You don't approve them, say nay. Ayes pass. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Anthony Alonji. I direct the Dislocated Worker Program and some related programs for the state of Minnesota. It's my intention here to give you as much information as I can about the Dislocated Worker Program and the Workforce Development Fund, which is the state special revenue fund that funds it. What we're going to be covering today is what the Dislocated Worker Program is and does, how we pay for the program, what kind of results we've achieved, and future strategic directions. I do want to take a note that won't be talking too much about the economy overall. I know you've probably been deluged with presentations about the state of the economy, what it's been like, what it's like now, what it might be like in the future. We also have internal resources, including Steve Hine, the director of our excellent labor market information team, who would be far more qualified than I would to give you detailed information about the economy, but I can tell you about, from our perspective as a program, what we've seen, and would be happy to answer questions about that topic or any other as we go. Just ask questions as you need to.
Okay.
So the Dislocated Worker Program, what is it? The first thing it is it's critical labor market exchange. If you can think back to your Economics 101 without suffering too much trauma, you'll remember that as the professor was up there and talking about these elegant demand and supply curves, they were also talking about assumptions that they were making, that goods and services could flow freely, information, it was all assumed away that all these problems that we'd actually suffer in the real world, you just snap your fingers and boom, workers can go and they need to go, people can just go get the things they need to get. That's obviously not true. People need to have the skills in order to serve in any market. They need to be able to get to the goods that they need to get. They need to hear about those markets. Labor market's no different. You need to be able to have the skills, get to where you need to go, live near where you work. And so the Dislocated Worker Program helps grease those wheels of the economy, the very fundamental wheels of an economy. They're a service to the businesses who are seeking skilled labor. That's what they are first and foremost. The Dislocated Worker Program, like most workforce development programs, needs employers, needs businesses in order for them to work, to have any sort of outcomes at all. We need to have businesses out there hiring. And so we make sure that whatever we help our job-seeking customers with, which is, of course, something else the Dislocated Worker Program does, whatever we provide to them is something that they actually need. We're also a pass-through grant program and requires oversight of local partners, nonprofit organizations. So we service a valuable function in terms of administering grants to folks and then making sure that the expenditures are appropriate and proper and that the taxpayers are well served. It's also it's a group, not just Dislocated Worker Program. There's actually two programs called the Dislocated Worker Program. Most people only think about it as one. There's a state-funded Dislocated Worker Program. There's a federal-funded Dislocated Worker Program. Comes out of something called the Workforce Investment Act. In addition to that, also in this unit and integrated with these programs, there is a Workforce Investment Act Title I-B adult program, which provides services to some adults who may not have been laid off but are in need of reemployment assistance. There's also a trade adjustment assistance program that's federally funded that's specific to trade-impacted sites. There's also national emergency grants, which folks may have heard of, which provide additional resources. There's also rapid response, which gets a separate funding stream, state and federal funding stream. State, it's specifically authorized in statute, separate from the rest of the Dislocated Worker Program. There's also several pilot programs that are all integrated here. But when somebody comes to the Dislocated Worker Program or somebody comes into a workforce center and hears about the Dislocated Worker Program, we don't give them all that. We just give them a seamless experience where they hear about maybe the Dislocated Worker Program and maybe trade adjustment assistance is about as complicated as we get because they need services. They don't need lots of bureaucratic names. So who is a dislocated worker? It's an eligibility-based program. It's not an entitlement program. It depends on the circumstances that individual faces and the determination of the counselor who is serving them. The broad eligibility requirements are that you have to be laid off through no fault of your own. It makes a certain amount of sense for dislocated worker program. We use the same definition as unemployment insurance, which maximizes efficiency because we only need to examine the matter once rather than having a whole determination made on the UI side and then have a dislocated worker step in and say, okay, now we're going to find out if you're really laid off through no fault of your own. We accept the unemployment insurance definition, and that is a much more efficient way of doing things. They have to have some attachment to the labor force recently. They have to have worked, at least in the definition we use, is the last 36 months. That may not sound like much of an attachment to a labor force, but if you've talked to, I'm sure you've all talked to constituents sometime in the last couple of years, who may have just barely that, and maybe before the last 3 years, they had a much greater attachment to the work to the workforce. So we're fairly generous in how we define labor attached. The important thing is that they did have a job, and they did get laid off from that job. Of course, they have to legally work in the United States, and they have to be at least 18 years old. There are youth programming resources for those who are under 18 that serve similar workforce development functions. So we focus on adults. So what does the program do? I want to explain, first of all, some of the pictures that you're going to see here are actual dislocated worker customers. They're available, the full stories are available in the State Dislocated Worker Report. We came around and passed this around to your offices a couple weeks ago. If anybody needs another copy for yourselves or for staff, I can certainly furnish that for you. We also have it electronically on our website. In this case, we're looking at Marianne Stokel from Ascenti County, and what the program does is it helps people like her. It helps people like her who find themselves perhaps with some work history. They don't have an actual degree. Every bit of training they've gotten has been gotten from the company that they've worked for 15, 20 years. And then they get laid off someday, and they realize that to work somewhere else in the same style position or the next step up, they have no chance because they don't have that Bachelor of Science in Management, or they don't have the kinds of degrees or certifications that they need in order to be gainfully employed again. So in order to get them a job at a comparable wage and a comparable commuting distance, we need to give them services that can be any one of a number of different services. There are four broad categories to these. The next few slides will get into these in more detail. But the basic categories to keep in mind are job search and placement, career planning and counseling, approved training, and support services. Taking each in turn, job search and placement. The use of the newspaper here is ironic. Nobody uses the classifieds in the newspaper anymore to find a job. Nowadays, folks who may have just lost their job, maybe the last time they were looking for a job, they were looking in the classifieds. And the newspapers is all they know. And they don't know how to go about internet job search and job engines. Sure, they've seen CNN.com articles on it. They may even be web savvy. But they've never built a resume online. They've never done any sort of search for jobs online, and they have no idea how to find those things. So we help them with those things through creative job workshops. We help them build the resume. Of course, we give them interviewing practice, and we give them job networking groups and employer fairs. We have most of our one-stop centers, our workforce centers across the state, have relationships with multiple employers, and they have the employer of the week is Target Corporation. The employer of the week is it could be Hutchinson Technology. It could be any one of a number of things. Folks come in and they say, okay, this is what we're hiring, this is what we're doing, and this is where we're going. And they may even be conducting interviews during those times. And so we provide that service and job leads to folks. Career planning and counseling, a little more intensive now, a little more one-on-one time. Instead of being in a workshop with 20, 30 other people learning about how to build your resume, maybe now you're actually talking to somebody about the labor market information in your area, what it means for you, your hopes and your dreams, not to get too inspirational here, but the idea here is that people want to do work that they want to do. And we want to help them within the limits of the local labor market and, of course, their own capabilities. And we have to help them about 300 highly trained and qualified career counselors. The number could be a little bit bigger than that, a little bit lower than that, depending on what year you're talking about. The reason I don't have a specific number for you is because these aren't DEED employees, not all of them anyway. Some of them are. But a lot of these are nonprofits. Some of them work for the public sector. Many of them are nonprofit employees, places like Career Management Services, Quality Career Services, Minnesota Teamsters Bureau. Just independent nonprofits that either have this as the primary mission or a primary mission among several. But whatever organization you're talking with, or whoever's hiring that counselor, they're committed to tailored, customized service. And they make sure that they are sitting down, making most of the decisions with that customer, because we find the best person to approve a plan, to move forward with that customer, isn't those of us in our offices in St. Paul, making judgments upon people about whether they can go be this or go be that or use this information. It's the person that you sit down across the desk from and you look at them and you shake their hand and you get to know them. Maybe you already know them, so you live in the community with them. And those are the people that we want, helping people make decisions about their own futures. Despite that desire for face-to-face contact, it's been difficult. Caseloads have remained very high throughout the recession and the subsequent recovery. I'll give you a sense of this. In a normal economy, if there is such a thing, about 40 to 1 or 80 to 1, depending on where you are in the state and what kind of layoffs you may be going through during that normal economic churn. That's what a counselor can expect to see, about 40 or 80 customers, somewhere in that range. In 2009, caseloads appear to have peaked. I certainly hope they peaked. In surveys of counselors, some in the metro area reported caseloads of up to 200 to 300 to 1. Massive amounts of customers, and they had a very difficult time trying to provide the kind of service that they are used to providing, and they had to undergo some new models. In some cases, they did small group counseling, tried to find people with similar interests and group them together in small groups and try to work them as a little job networking club and counseling all in one. They just did everything they possibly could to help these folks, and they continue to do so. Caseloads have remained close to that peak. They backed off a little bit due to the nature of the services customers are getting now, long-term training. The counseling, the heavy counseling duty is done, but they still have to check in with these customers every 30 days or every 90 days, depending on what kind of service they're getting. So there's still a lot of work to be done. It's just that that person doesn't need their focused attention as much. So we have a lot of customers still in the system. I'll get to the specific statistics in a moment as to how many are in the system and how much longer they've been staying. But that is definitely a phenomenon that we're facing now, is high caseloads that haven't quite gone away. Our counselors do require a regular upgrading of skills. Just as you would want teachers to have the latest skills as they teach our children various things, you would want our counselors to have the latest techniques. And we use a wide range of technical assistance, everything from the cheapest newsletter you can imagine sent electronically to hundreds of counselors at a time, to a conference that we do annually and webinars and other things that we do to make sure these counselors have all the knowledge about policy, all the skills that they need, all the networking opportunities they have, so they can learn from each other and the state as to how to do their jobs the very best that they can. So let's talk a little bit about the training. Training may or may not be part of a job seeker plan. A lot of laid off workers, maybe say from the healthcare industry, if you're an LPN and you got laid off, there may be an LPN job waiting for you, not too far away. You just don't know about it yet. Maybe you don't know about online resumes. Maybe you don't know about a couple of things. And with a little help of a career counselor, a job networking club, a workshop or two, you can be back on your feet and have that new job within a few weeks or a few months. And in that case, training is obviously not going to be part of the plan. In many other cases, training must be part of the plan. Out of the 30,000 dislocated workers we served in last fiscal year, the year ending June 30th, 2010, 19,600 of those, about 64%, participated in some sort of training activity. So it gives you a sense of, and that's historically a little bit high. It's usually a little bit lower than that, but during the recession, we had more people go to training because jobs were not available for them. So training became a more popular option. Counselors, of course, they're going to use labor market information to both establish an employment goal, and they're also going to make sense that employment goal makes sense from a labor market perspective, and not just a statewide labor market. They're going to be looking much more focused. We break down information into local areas, and we use those. We use tools to help people look at those. Those tools include an occupations and demands database that we use with folks. And so those of you that want to look it up, you can Google Minnesota Occupations in Demand. It's the first thing. And you can get take a look at what kind of jobs are out there, what the salary is, the 25th quartile salary, the 75th quartile salary, where you can get training for that job if you don't have it already. Links right into the wonderful website, iseek.org, which is sort of a foundational website for the program and a lot of other employment training programs in the state of Minnesota. Job stat is another one. If those of you who, if you just got laid off from a manufacturing industry and you're wondering how your skills might be transferable into something besides manufacturing, depending on the occupation you have, you may already have a lot of the skills you need to succeed in healthcare or a different manufacturing industry. And so we would work through that database with you, that job stat database. And again, Googling Minnesota job stat can get you all sorts of information. Once the counselor takes a look at that plan, they of course have to approve it, and they have to sign off on it. They have to make sure that it is something that makes sense. They are that first line of defense for the taxpayer to make sure that we're spending taxpayer dollars wisely. Training can last anywhere from a few weeks to 2 years. What's typical is about a year to 2 years, but there's training, a certification, upgrading a certification of some sort. It only takes a few weeks, and where we can find opportunities like that, we certainly take advantage of them. The last fourth category of services for the Dislocated Worker Program is support services. This is not the focus of the Dislocated Worker Program. This is not both in state statute and federal statute. You can take a look and see. It's not where we're supposed to be 100% focused. And in fact, in state statute, there are limits as to how much in any given grant we can spend on support services. But that said, some customers do need assistance beyond training. Their car breaks down. They don't have child care. There's something going on. They're missing a health care payment, and they're just not focused on the job search because they need that 1 month of something to get them, to bridge them until some other source of revenue kicks in. And in those cases, there are absolutely opportunities for that counselor. It's counselor discretion within the caps and the average the average cost parameters that we set for them, that they can help folks out with those needs. Again, we emphasize, and every local area has their own support services policy, which is very strict, and we have our state level policy as well. We understand this is not the primary purpose of the program. We can't replace Minnesota Care or do other things, but we can fill in some gaps that are critical, that without filling in those gaps, maybe that job search isn't as successful as it could be. So how do we pay for all this? You know, we do put a lot of heart into the program. Heart alone doesn't pay the bills, so I hope you'll forgive the graphic. In this case, we need to make sure that we have funding behind all of this. In Minnesota, the good news is that we have a unique and powerful funding mechanism. It's called the Workforce Development Fund. I know several of you are very, very familiar with it. Bear with me as I go through some of the basics. I would say that much of our state's success with Dislocated Worker, and I mean success both looked at objectively, we are successful with a lot of our customers, job seekers and employers who hire them, but also as you compare us nationally around the country, the reason why Minnesota succeeds so much, such a higher level than other folks in this region or even the country, is because we have this fund. This is a unique resource, and it's something that we're very happy to have, and we pay extra attention to our responsibility given that we have it. What is the Workforce Development Fund? It's a state special revenue fund. It collects about $45 million a year, and this is for multiple programs, including the Dislocated Worker Program. It's funded through an assessment which gets collected with the unemployment insurance tax. And that fee is currently at 0.12% per year on the first $27,000 of a wages that an employer pays an individual. This is currently scheduled to decrease to 0.1% per year as of July 1st, 2011.
I think Representative Scalzi has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is regarding what you call this unique and powerful funding mechanism. It's actually a tax on businesses.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I'm just kind of curious. The funding mechanism was 0.10, and then it went to 0.12 last year, scheduled to decrease again to 0.10% this July. I'm kind of wondering, what is the status of the fund? Is there a surplus in it, and is this a prime candidate for budget balancing exercises as we go through the rest of the session?
Mr. Lange.
Mr. Chair and Representative and committee members, you'll be glad to know that your staff are excellent in their job, and they have already asked us some of these questions. In fact, Ron, I owe you one of these copies of paper here. The Workforce Development Fund is not in surplus. In fact, we did not have enough funds. I'll get to that slide in a moment, but we did not have enough funds to meet the demand last year. We ended up with a waiting list of something on the order of about 2,000 because we did not have enough funding to meet the obligations to meet the demand that was out there. As of this year, we're doing slightly better than we were last year. I don't know if we'll have much of a waiting list, but we do not anticipate having any balance that is left over. In the past, historically, we have had large balances. I absolutely will say, if you look at the history, 16 million, 12 million from year to year during a good economy. About the time, it was an unfortunate coincidence, about the time where the legislature and governor at that time transferred about $8 million away to help with the general fund, the recession struck. And the rainy day came. And it was a little bit difficult, and it was nobody's fault, of course. I mean, people were making the best judgments they could, and us included. I think I even said, I think we can make it myself. We couldn't. Nobody anticipated that recession. So as we recover from this recession, I would say that the amount of resources we have in the fund may be enough to get us through this year. Probably not. We'll probably have to delay services for some folks at least a quarter, it would be my guess. We are currently looking at on the sheet you'll see a positive balance for the end of the year projected at $500,000. That is a projection. There are two more. The nature of the fund, and I'll get to this again in a moment, the nature of the fund is such that we don't know what we're going to have until the end of the year. And so it depends on the UI collections. And the more hiring there is and the more wages paid out, the higher the collections are. And so if in a good economy, obviously you collect more than you need. In a poor economy, you collect less. So last year, we were at this point, and I had a sheet of paper that looked a lot like this, and it had about $500,000 left over. And then we got hit with two more adjustments, and each one took down collections by $2 million. So I'm going to give Mr. Soderberg a piece of paper that says there's $500,000 left in the fund. That's a projected number, and I would urge this committee and the legislature to be very careful with it. I would submit that we don't want to run out again.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the, I actually have a couple of questions here. You said you collected on a 1.2 fee on wages, and it's going to go down to a 0.1. I'm sorry, 1.0. What kind of a decrease in actual dollars do you foresee that to be?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney and committee members, every time you adjust up or down 0.01, you're talking about $4.5 million. So if you think about it in terms of 2%, that's about $9 million. You're talking about a jump up or down depending on what direction you're going. So if you think about it in those terms, that's the net effect.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney.
So, and last year you had to delay delay services to the unemployed, and you seem to indicate that that's likely to happen again this year. Mm-hmm. Do you have a number of how many you think that's going to be? I mean, you think you're going to have to delay services for 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000, and what's the cost of removing that delay for those people?
I'm just writing down both parts of the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. The number is was at one time, like I said last year, was about 2,000. We went and found a national emergency grant that only Minnesota got. We were unique in getting it, and I want to thank the team that works for me for getting it because they did wonderful work on it. And it lessened the rolls by about 1,100. That leaves us presumably about 900 to go. The 900 over time has dwindled for a variety of reasons. Part of it is their turn has come up and more funding has become available with time. We cancel out some project grants. We wash the money back in the fund. We ask who out there needs it, and we get those waiting lists down. So that's one possible outcome for those 900 and where they are today. The next thing that can happen is some people can find a job on their own. Stroke of luck, uncle's just working some place and happens to have a job opening, and that has happened. We do have anecdotal evidence that people have, as the economy has recovered, have been able to find work on their own. Whether or not it's their optimal job or not, we don't know because we can't track them. And then the third possible outcome, as you may suspect, is that some people just give up. Some people just vanish off the list or are still on the list but are dormant. In polling our local areas, our partners that have waiting lists, my best guess at this time is that we've got a couple hundred across the state still on there. My hope is that we don't have to add to it more than by about 100 or so. I'm talking in orders of magnitude here. In other words, I don't expect it to be 1,000. I don't expect it to be much more than that. I expect it to be in the low hundreds. That doesn't necessarily make me an optimist, but I'm hoping that we can get through that list in short order.
One more? Representative Mahoney.
You spoke earlier on the natural churn of jobs, and we have a lot of new members on the committee.
Sure.
I think I've asked this question a couple of years in a row. Could you explain what you mean by the natural churn of jobs in the state and how large it is?
Mr. Chair and Representative, natural churn is a term that economists use because they're not being laid off. natural churn does not feel natural to the person who's going through the churn. As we know, several of our people on our team who work on this program are counselors. Those of us who have, you know, continue to work with these people know being laid off is one of the most traumatic events a person can face, short of a medical trauma. And it's something that we approach very, we don't approach it casually at all. So I don't want the use of my terms to be taken as anything other than a literary convenience. The natural turn can, what we process through the dislocated worker program is what I can best speak to. The natural turn is much larger than that. A lot of people find jobs on their own. In any given layoff of 100 people, only 50 or 60 may use dislocated worker services. So there's always a fraction above and beyond what we see. That said, in a more normal economy, I actually have an old annual report here from about 2006, or what we in the program like to call the good old days, where we served, we only had a service to about, in the state program, about 11,721 people. And this year, what your report will say is that we served with state funds north of 20,000, so double that. So in an economy that is not in recession, we might see about half as many people laid off, about half as many people come through the program. Again, I'm speaking in rough proportions here, but that gives you the right order of magnitude, I hope.
Thank you. Representative Stensrud.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the work you do in this department, having been churned myself over the years. But I was wondering, something I'm asking a lot of the different departments, just so I get an understanding, do you provide vehicles for some employees? Are there like state-provided vehicles throughout your organization? Can you quantify that?
Mr. Lange.
Mr. Chair and Representative and committee members, we do not provide a vehicle. We might, for the dislocated worker program, we might pay for 1 month of a car payment, say, or we might pay for a repair to a vehicle that has suddenly been, rendered inoperative for some reason. The person needs to get to job interviews, needs to get certain things. It's at a counselor discretion. I'm not going to have the absolute total of how much we pay on it would fall within a transportation category, which also includes bus passes and things like that. So I don't know if I could split out cars specifically very easily, but in terms of the very temporary payment, it can only really be one time. It's not meant to. We can't pay for somebody's car. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. They would hit the threshold of 15% on a grant way too fast, and they wouldn't be able to do it.
Okay. Chairman? Yeah, just to clarify, I sort of went a little different way than I was thinking, but okay. Informative. Thank you. How about for your employees and for your staff? Are there state-owned vehicles that are used by the workforce?
Oh, I understand your question. Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm sorry I misunderstood your question. We do not, at Deed, we have, I think it's three state vehicles there's three vehicles, and we'll get you how we use them and such, but it's not a common use.
Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and like you say, that was informative, Representative Stensrud, because I certainly wouldn't want to think that we're taxing our businesses to, and regardless of their history of layoffs, you might have a business that has no layoffs, mm-hmm. And paying this tax, mm-hmm. and then the money would be going, what I would assume to be for counseling and job training, but instead might go for a car payment or something connected with childcare. That's troubling to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, all I can do is point you to Statute 116L, Subdivision 5, where we, 116L.17, Subdivision 5, where it is currently an allowable use. It is one that I urge us to continue to be an allowable use. The federal program allows it to be a use because they understand that some folks, when they are out of work, in order for them to get to job interviews, need to be able to get there. Again, this isn't a continuing on month after month after month of the program. This is, my car broke down. I don't know how I'm going to get to not only my part-time job that's keeping groceries on my table, but also how I'm going to get to the three job interviews I've lined up this week. I live in rural Minnesota. I can't get anywhere without a car. What am I going to do? I would submit that we have had some people who, without that support service, would have been negative outcomes of this program. and the training dollars that we've invested in them would have been lost as a result.
And Mr. Chair, and thank you for that explanation, and it is in the law, you're saying. What I guess what I'm getting at is this would seem more like a general fund human services type expenditure rather than a tax on businesses to pay for this type of cost to somebody that can't get to a job interview. That's my own personal opinion.
Mr. Chair and Representative, as an elected official myself, I respect, with the City of Hastings, I respect the fact that you have that opinion on it, and as you will, you know, let me know how we can help.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess it's unfortunate a number of people don't understand the advantage of that, and I remember you worked with me on a program. I believe some might have been Mankato had it, but Hennepin County had one. It was they backed off because of extreme right-wing radio criticism, and they had a 93% success rate with a loan program where they would advance money so that because it's so hard with public transportation to get to a lot of jobs in the metro area, they would advance the money. 93% of them paid back the loan entirely and end up paying all of the costs of that for the auto. And all of those people, of course, then became they were no longer on the funds. We weren't paying for them. They were paying taxes in. So it was a good program. It was unfortunate that people that really didn't understand it pushed getting rid of it. But it was at one point it was both sides of the aisle, both parties understood it, and it's just unfortunate that those things happen, where we're actually getting people back to paying good taxes for us.
Mr. Lange.
Thank you. A little bit more on that workforce development fund, and this I'll go quickly through because we happen to cover some of this material. About $45 million in forecast revenue for this year. Again, that's not a hard number. It may be a little bit higher. It might be a little bit lower. It's likely to be a little bit lower. Of that $45 million, $18 million goes into direct appropriations for programs identified by the legislature before the disabled worker gets its statutory appropriation. So, again, I want to emphasize that when I say there, you know, we take that $45 million, subtract $18 million. The reason I haven't given you, I'm sure you can all do the math in your heads. The reason I haven't specified this is how much we have in the program is because we just don't know how much really will be left in the program by the time we're done. It should be somewhere in the order of about $30 million in collections. The Minnesota Job Skills Partnership is a multi-stakeholder board that actually oversees the state funds for the Disability Worker Program. It includes a delegate from the House. It includes a delegate from the Senate. It's usually staff that are appointed. It also includes appointees from the governor and appointees, you know, that represent business, labor, education institutions. And they review the operations of the Disability Worker Program. And where policy changes may be necessary, they approve those, you know, any major changes, and oversee the fund as it goes throughout the year. I'm going to leave the topic of workforce development fund and talk about so what do you get for your money? What comes out of all this? And this is a summary slide. I'll get into more detail in a moment. As a result of this fund, we serve twice as many laid off workers. We create a competitive environment in which public providers have to compete with private. And we complete reporting and other accountability functions twice as quickly. Let's talk about some of these in a little more detail. I apologize. I skipped over one of our fine customers, Jennifer Williams, from the Twin Cities area. Somebody who was laid off wanted to stay in the financial industry. The resume was old. The only training she'd received throughout the years, tell me if it sounds familiar, had been company-sponsored. She didn't have any certification of her own. She'd been in the workforce a long time. The licenses she held, they were about to expire. As a result of her involvement in the Disability Worker Program, she got a portable credential and got employment at Sterling Retirement Resources, a financial planning firm, and she's doing what she she truly enjoys and in the industry she was in before, but just didn't have the certifications to continue in. So as a result of this program, she was a successful customer. So back to this, the idea of more customers served, and here's the numbers, put as simply as possible. For state fiscal year 2010, again, the fiscal year ended last June, Federal Workforce Investment Act funding, that is the federal resources that go into dislocated worker, paid for services for a little fewer than 10,000 customers, job-seeking customers. For that same period, the State Workforce Development Fund paid for services to 20,507. There's a little bit of overlap, but maybe a couple hundred on both where they're co-enrolled. That state funding pays for part of it, federal funding picked it up, or vice versa. But generally speaking, you're talking about 2-to-1 ratio here. It's varied over the past several years. Sometimes it's more like 1.5-to-1 on the funding. More often than not, it's over 2 or even 3 dollars for every of the state dollars. It's not a matching program. It's not anything like that. It's just what happens to have come in and what we get from the federal government. States, neighboring states, who see what we're able to do for our laid-off workers, look at that and their jaws absolutely drop in envy in that we are able to get those laid-off people. They have waiting lists every year. Every year for them is almost like a recession, and what we've experienced these last couple of years. In Minnesota, we've had the foresight to set up a fund that actually meets the demand and actually gets job seekers to employers, so that we can have the highest skilled workforce possible. Second point, competition for services, and we usually look a little more coordinated than this. We have a unique model here where we widen the pool of providers because we have more resources. It doesn't have to go just to our local workforce service areas, as wonderful as they are and as amazing providers as they are and as good as their outcomes are. We believe they're even better because they are forced to compete for mass layoff project dollars with private nonprofit organizations who are specifically certified. I'm not going to get into the entire model here. I see time's running short, and it's probably more interesting to me than it is to most people here. But those of you that have questions about this competitive model, I'll simply point out that we fix the price, and we have them compete on the services they'll give for that price. So this panel of workers that have just been laid off will, on behalf of their colleagues, you know, they'll sit at a table, much like you are sitting at a table, and the providers will come up one at a time, much like I'm coming up before you. And it's a little bit meant to reflect a little bit like a job interview, and a sort of empowering experience where they get to say, you know what, you aren't really meeting our needs. We have specific needs here that you don't have on your resume. Or how do you plan to meet those, Mr. Provider or Ms. Provider? How are you going to meet those needs? And how are you going to specifically tailor your services to what we have that's unique here at this plant or at this financial firm or wherever they may be being laid off from? And the entire system is much more responsive because it's not automatic. You don't automatically get the grant. You got to work for it. So, and quicker, better accountability. We are allowed by statute to use up to 5% for administrative functions. We don't. We believe in trying to run as lean an operation as humanly possible. Our actual percentage is actually about 4%. And we use the funds that we do have to improve the case management, performance reporting, and other critical data structures that we do have from other sources, but that we would not be able to report. I'll give you an example. Our Workforce One case management system has to have about a dozen changes just for the dislocated worker program, it seems like every month. We would only get to about 3 or 4 or 5 of those. And this case management system is the system that when you ask us the question, how many customers do X? How many customers really get to Y? How many customers do that? Our ability to answer those questions depends on these systems. And the fact that we can improve them as quickly as we would like to is a huge deal for us. And it's not something that you will often see. It's sort of one of the hidden values of what we're able to do. Without the Workforce Development Fund and its resources, we would be a little slower to respond. We would not be as accurate. And that would not make for as good government. What has the program experienced over the last couple of years? Again, since we talked about this, I'll keep this short. Looks on the graph, you know, whew, good thing that's over, right? Unfortunately, what that represents is us hitting the wall around the first quarter of state fiscal year 10, and we couldn't enroll people because we had to put them on a waiting list. We didn't have funds. So that sharp drop you see is not the economy getting miraculously better, although it was starting to improve by that time. It was us not being able to take on as many customers. So two forces working simultaneously here. We've talked enough about that phenomenon, so I'll move on. So we've served more customers for longer training periods. I talked about the number of customers we've served, about 20,000 through the state, about another 10,000 through federals, for a total of 30,646 unique customers. I put some numbers up here for comparison to past years so you can see the growth. It is substantial. as you would expect. And the main phenomenon to point out, and I previewed this before, these customers are more likely to take training, of course, during a recession. Everybody's more likely to take training. When I graduated from back in 1991, I was more likely to take training. I stayed in school because I saw what was out there. And we've seen a similar phenomenon here. People will use this opportunity smartly and rightly to upgrade their skills so that when the economy improves, they're ready for it. So as a result, the average days, number of days in the program has dramatically increased over the last 2 years. So, what have we accomplished? These are our four outcomes. They are the outcomes that by federal rule we are obligated to follow. I mean, we'd follow it anyway. We'd be interested to know. But specifically, we follow these four about getting a job, keeping a job, what you make in your job, and whether or not you got a portable credential as you get your job. So that if you lose the second job, your chances of getting another job increase. Maybe you don't have to come back into the dedicated worker program and use more taxpayer resources. Maybe instead you just go right back into the workforce because you've got that credential. So these are four pretty important things. We also use them to track the state performance as well, so that again, everything, all the incentives are aligned. It's one program, unified, moving forward, very efficient. Over 86% of program exiters get a job. Even more of a percentage keep that job for at least 6 months. $40,000 a year. Yeah, it is a real figure. It's backed up by wage detail. This is not self-reporting. Yeah, I'm making tons of money. You know, we don't just ask the customers. We actually look into wage detail, which is the information that comes out of unemployment insurance records and tax records. Okay, so these are official figures that we are able to track, and the meaningful credential, generally speaking, a degree, but it could be a technical certificate in some cases or other things like that. Something portable that you would recognize. Yeah, okay. If I'm in that industry and I'm an employer, I get what that is. That means something to me. What else have we accomplished? Growing America Through Entrepreneurship is a pilot program that we're operating with federal dollars. It has provided significant consulting services through our small business development centers, which also are at DEED. It's been a really great example of integrating, I think, the legislative vision from a few years ago when they first had the merger of economic security and trade and economic development was that we would do more things like this. Make workforce development more like economic development and vice versa. And this is a pilot program. 300 laid off Minnesotans have gotten something out of it. 135 of them have gotten classroom training. 80 businesses over the last 2 years, either have been launched or grown with the help of this program. Now, dedicated worker resources don't go into the consulting services. That's small business development centers that are taking care of that. So we keep the stream separate. Dedicated worker pays for what statute allows it to pay for. But it is something that we're able to get some wonderful results. And the gentleman here, incidentally, from Winona, Tim Golden, he's somebody who used to be an electronic technician at Watlow Controls in Winona. Unfortunately, they had a layoff, and he decided to start his own business. As a result of this, he felt like he knew enough about electronics, and he was interested in solar energy, and played around with panels. Maybe not jumped on them like Commissioner Surge knows people who do that, but I don't. Maybe they certainly work with them. And as a result, he and his business partner started a company called Winona Renewable Energy. His financial outlook is good. He reports he anticipates his annual income will be more than double of that of the job that he got laid off from. And perhaps sometime in the near future, he'll be employing people. And that will be good for future people in the program. Anything else we've accomplished? Sure, we've accomplished a lot. I'll just mention two more things. We have brought in federal dollars, $16 million in national emergency grants to serve 4,200 Minnesotans from layoffs that range from Delta Airlines, Target, Hutchinson Technology, BAE Systems, many others. We also have done something that no other state in the union, as of last year anyway, I think Missouri was going to try it this year. We co-enroll every single person who would be eligible for the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, which is a federal program. We co-enroll them in this program so that the two programs benefit from each other, and we reduce the administrative overhead that's necessary to serve them. In other states, you have two separate counselors, you have two separate systems that bring in, take in, and track this customer. We have one set. We still have a specialist that has to approve a given plan. But the fact is, we are much smoother in our operations. I do want to say, in terms of results, you saw some of those results from before. For that subset of workers that are co-enrolled, for the three quarters ending June 30th, 2010, and this is hundreds of workers, this isn't three or four workers. Our TA performance for entered employment, 100%. Our retention rate, 98.8%. Our average annual wage was about $32,000. And by comparison, the U.S. averages for the same time period were 59.6%, 78.9% for retention, and about a little less than $30,000. So what we are able to do here in Minnesota compared to the rest of the country makes us competitively speaking just simply a better place to be looking for workers and a better place to be a worker.
Representative Mulrich, you had a question.
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this will bring up something you definitely remember because we worked together when we both first came in on it. Do you have figures? We, Bob and I, tried to get figures after like 2 years, 3 years, 5 years for our different training programs, and I know the workforce development ones have much better figures, is my understanding. But do you have those for 2, 3, 5 years out after they're first employed? Because I noticed you have them after 6 months, but mm-hmm. I'm always interested in the long run. And I'm guessing that, anecdotally, I've always heard that the dislocated worker programs have better results in the long run, but do you have figures for that at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller and committee members, the short answer is no. Right by the point we would have picked up that sort of initiative as a pilot program, the recession hit, and all staff resources had to go to just keeping our heads above water. So I would like to be able to dance around that question and give you some sort of half certainty, but I can't operate that way. I apologize.
Representative Kiefer.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for your work. It seems like you go above and beyond helping these people find employment, and I appreciate that. There are some private, like temporary services, and I know that they don't go to the extent that you do, mm-hmm. but when they do place people, they'll kind of negotiate with the employer mm-hmm. and get a little bit of money back as mm-hmm. kind of a payment from their services. So mm-hmm. you're not charged ahead of time, but they do Absolutely. Make a profit.
Sure.
I know that you guys are pinched for money. Has this ever come across the board, or do you do that at all? Thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative, and committee members, the short answer is yes. We work with them all the time, in fact. When we enter by the time we enter a workplace, even if they've given their workers advance notice, some employers will have already, Lee Hecht Harrison is an example of a firm that does this. Wonderful firm. They're good partners to us. We work with them all the time. And we work alongside them. And what we do is we say, look, anything the employer is already paying you to do, we don't have to do it. It tends to be stuff like the more job search, the workshops, resume writing, stuff like that. If it's already being provided by the private sector, we don't need to be part of it. We don't need to do that. We don't need to deliver that. So what we do is we then look for what our separate value added will be for a given mass layoff. And we'll focus more on the training aspects. We'll focus more on the counseling, the one-on-one counseling. Counseling usually comes with a term. With the private firms, for obvious reasons, they can only commit to a certain amount of time. So they may say for 3 months or for 6 months. We commit, of course, for as long as it takes to get that worker up to a couple years. So we find the gaps that the private sector is not already providing, and we stick to our knitting, so to speak. We stick to the things where we can add the sharpest value. That doesn't mean we never do a workshop. There might be people who miss the Lee Hecht Harrison workshop, or they get laid off in waves, and people don't hear the things as they may get into a workshop. But in terms of the counseling and the training components become vastly more important at that point.
I'll try to be quick. We have to get out of here. Thank you. Do the customer, you call them customers, the mm-hmm. employee who eventually gets the job through the mm-hmm. program, do they ever pay back part of, is it a voluntary thing, or do they pay a mm-hmm. fee back to you guys, or for your help?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the short answer is no. They're not obligated to, nor do they pay back.
Okay.
There's some strategic priorities that lay here, and I'll cut short.
That the average dislocated worker gets reemployed in how many weeks? It used to be 12 weeks back, before the recession.
Right.
Is it still basically the same at 80% of the salary that they left? That was one of the things I used to brag about your program.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you can still say that the wage is very high. We don't track it like we used to. The federal government changed the way they do the measures, so we don't track the percentage of wage. We just have the actual number. It's $40,000 is the average wage. I think they like that plain English version better. So I don't know what percentage that is of their original wage anymore because we don't have the systems to track that. What I can also say is how long it takes. Unfortunately, they are spending much longer in the program, as I noted. They're spending sometimes over a year in the program before they do get reemployed.
I assumed it would be longer.
If there are any more questions, my contact information is on the presentation in a box. I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.